I would never in a million years have ever thought, I know what, I should write a Poirot novel. It just wouldn't have occurred to me. As far as I was concerned, the only person who had ever written Poirot was Agatha Christie. No one else ever would. I didn't think anyone else ever should. It just wasn't a thing.
That's Sophie Hanna, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Sophie Hanna is a New York Times and Amazon number one best-selling author of numerous psychological thrillers. She's also the author of five previous Hercule Poirot mysteries authorized by the Agatha Christie estate. She joins us to talk about The Last Death of the Year. Sophie, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Well, this is your latest, the sixth book you've written about Hercule Poirot. And this one, tell us about the plot here. Where do you take listeners this time?
Well, it's set on a fictional Greek island, and Hercule Poirot is invited to stay with a group of friends who are living in an old stone house by the sea on this Greek island. And he arrives with his sidekick, Inspector Catchpole. They arrive on New Year's Eve. And almost the first thing that happens is they have a big dinner to celebrate New Year's Eve. And then they play a game involving New Year's resolutions. And everyone writes a resolution on a bit of paper and puts it in a hat. And then the game is that one by one, the resolutions are pulled out of the hat and read aloud. And everyone has to guess which one is whose. And this is actually based on a game that I invented for me and my family to play on New Year's Eve, although everyone actually refused to play it, but I invented it in the hope that they would agree. Anyway, so that is what happens. And the third resolution pulled out of the hat is actually a declaration of intent to murder somebody. And the prospective victim is named, and he's one of the people in the group celebrating New Year's Eve. And there's a cryptic element to this death threat, because it says that the murder of this particular person will be the last and first death of the year. So the book is called The Last Death of the Year. Poirot immediately wonders, what can that possibly mean? Like, how can any murder be both the last and the first death of the year? But also, why would anyone put the words in that order when it's so much more expected to say the first and last death of the year? So Poirot is very puzzled by all of that, and also determined to prevent a murder from taking place. And unfortunately, he does not succeed. There is a murder that happens very soon afterwards, and then Poirot has to solve it. That's basically the setup. And the group of friends who are living in this stone house on this fictional island, or this beautiful bay on this fictional island, they call themselves the Very Good Friends, and they're a kind of very small and newly formed religious community who they all believe that they have invented a better version of Christianity than the version that Jesus invented. So they're quite arrogant, but they firmly believe that they know exactly what traditional Christianity is doing wrong and that they've improved upon it. And yeah, so they are, that's the group of friends that Poirot and Catchpole are living in this house with while trying to solve this murder and also to prevent future murders.
And in the beginning of the novel, Catchpole shares with us those resolutions, except for the one that says they're going to murder someone. And he says, in retrospect, we could have figured out who the murderer was on the basis of those resolutions. But unfortunately, they didn't figure that out until after the fact.
Yes. And I really love that prologue because, yeah, I mean, Catchpole says, look, we didn't see it. But looking now at this list of New Year's resolutions, it's totally possible to work out who the murderer is just from reading these resolutions, knowing nothing else about anything. So that's obviously a challenge to the reader because the reader at that point knows nothing about these characters. And we just get a list, and this is like page one or two, you know, we get a list of all the resolutions and which person, you know, which one belongs to which character. And what I fervently hope is that the reader will read the resolutions and think, I have no idea who the murderer is. What does Catchpole mean? How on earth could it be possible that you could read those resolutions and know which one was written by the murderer? That's what I want readers to think. And so far, from everyone I've heard from who's read the book, no one has read the list of resolutions and been able to work it out. But then in the epilogue, and I won't obviously give any spoilers, Poirot and Catchpole come back to that list of resolutions. And that's when the reader is, by this point, we already know who killed who and why. But it's only in the epilogue, the very last page, that the reader is told what Catchpole means and how it's possible to work out who the murderer is just from the resolutions. And at that point, hopefully the reader looks again at the list and goes, oh, of course. So that's what I've intended. Hopefully it works. Everyone who's read it so far and has told me says that does absolutely work. Because obviously it would spoil it massively if people actually could guess in the prologue who the murderer is.
Well, that's the challenge for the reader, but obviously the challenge for you as the author to set this all up. And, you know, it's very complicated. We might think this person did it or that person did it and the reasons why, but, you know, it's a puzzle that you have to put together with a plausible solution to that puzzle. So I'm curious about sort of the creative process of how do you work through all that to come up with a plot that works for you and is intriguing to the readers?
So in terms of the how, the honest answer is I'm not quite sure how it all comes together. But what I can say is, so every book starts with one idea that I love, and it's either the ending or the beginning. I don't think I've ever started a book with an idea that I've loved for the middle. It's always either this is an amazing premise, like this is an amazing mystery hook, or this is an amazing solution to a mystery or twist at the end of a mystery. With The Last Death of the Year, the first idea I had was actually not even the ending, a motive for murder, a particular motive. And as soon as I thought of that motive, I just knew I loved it so much that I had to use it. That was the starting point. So then I thought, right, and this is what I do with all my books. I thought, right, I'll just let that sit there in my brain for a while and do absolutely nothing until something occurs to me that would be the perfect beginning for that to lead us towards that ending. Then once I've got the beginning and the ending, then again, I just go, okay, now I'm just going to wait until I have some amazing ideas for points in the middle. And then once enough bits have been filled in, then I'll sit down and turn what I've been storing in my head into a plan document, like a book plan document. And at that point, I start typing things up and ordering them in the way that they need to be ordered. And so I know how that works. The part that I genuinely don't know how it works is what makes the ideas appear and what makes me have the ideas that I then think are good enough to put in. And I think what probably happens is my entire brain at this point knows that its job, its main job in life, is to come up with intriguing, satisfying, challenging murder mystery puzzles. So because it knows that's its job, it just gets on with doing that. And then when I have the feeling of like, oh, I've just had an amazing idea, that's because subconsciously my brain has been working away doing what it thinks is its main job, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So as an author, you're kind of doing the same thing that Poirot has to do. You know, he's presented with a problem. He has to figure out how that all came to end up like it does.
Yes, yes. I think the difference, though, is that for me, so much of the plot coming together just seems to happen by magic. Even like, so I've got an idea now that I'm very keen on for the next book I'm going to write. And that came in the form of a mysterious beginning of a story. So I had no idea what was going to happen in the end, no solution, no motive, no plot. I just had this amazing mystery hook that I knew I had to use as the starting point for my next book. As I was thinking about that hook, within maybe 20 seconds, I thought of something else that was going on in my life at the time and went, oh, and if I put that together with that, then the solution to the mystery could maybe be that. And it just seemed to happen. So sometimes it's stuff from real life. Sometimes it's stuff that occurs to me. But it's like the part of the process that I feel as though I don't control is the part where brilliant ideas pop up at the exact moments when I need them. And that just always happens. Didn't always used to, but now it really does always happen. And it's only when I've got enough of those brilliant ideas all revolving around one main story, that's when I sit down and think, okay, let's put this into a kind of satisfying shape. And I always do a very thorough plot plan with like every scene plotted out before I write it.
As you mentioned, this is the sixth book you've written in this series, but take us back to the beginning. How did you work with the estate and how did it come to pass that you were going to be writing these series of books?
It came about by complete coincidence. So I didn't have the idea myself. I would never in a million years have ever thought, I know what, I should write a Poirot novel. It just wouldn't have occurred to me. As far as I was concerned, the only person who had ever written Poirot was Agatha Christie. No one else ever would. I didn't think anyone else ever should. It just wasn't a thing. And from the Christie family's point of view, they'd never heard of me. So they wouldn't have thought of asking me to do it either. So it only came about because my agent, my literary agent, was in a meeting at HarperCollins offices. And he happened to be sitting next to a shelf full of Agatha Christie novels, and he remembered that I was a big Agatha Christie fan. So he just interrupted whatever the meeting was meant to be about and said, hey, I've got an author who's a massive Christie fan. Why don't you ask her to write a new Poirot novel? That would be amazing. And he just happened to make this suggestion at the exact moment that the Christie family had decided that they wanted new books by new authors with Christie's characters in. And it was just that coincidence of timing. So then we had a meeting, we discussed how it might work if I were to write a Poirot novel. And we just got on really well, agreed about everything, liked each other and decided to take a chance, really. Obviously, it was a much bigger chance for them than it was for me because, you know, Poirot is their precious character. It was a big deal for them to even consider letting a new writer write about Poirot. But the whole thing throughout all six books has been a really, really happy working experience. Like we've got on so well, worked so well together. Everything we've done on either side, the other side has loved. So every plot plan I've ever given them, every story suggestion, they've absolutely loved. Every editorial comment they've given me, I've found really helpful and useful. So it's been an incredibly smooth and happy experience from start to finish.
I'm curious about the challenge for you as an author, because obviously Agatha Christie is a legend, and there's a whole legion of fans that enjoy her writing and her style. So how do you honor her legacy, but also use your own voice as an author?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, I think it boils down to the difference between voice and everything else that goes into a Poirot novel. So I don't believe that one writer can or should mimic or try to copy another writer's voice or prose style, unless it's for like a literary game or something. But I knew from the start that I did not want to try and copy Agatha Christie's style as if I was pretending to be her. That would have felt very off to me, and I don't think I could have done it. I don't think one writer can mimic another in that way. But what I did know a lot about as a massive Christie fan and a massive Poirot fan was what are the storytelling characteristics and priorities of a Poirot novel. So in other words, as a Poirot fan, if I read a Poirot novel that didn't do certain things, I would say to myself, that's not a proper Poirot novel. There are certain things that a Poirot novel has to do and be, but it's all all of those things relate to prioritizing certain things in the story, organizing the story in a certain way. None of them relate to voice. So how I approached the voice thing was, I decided that since I was going to be a new person writing about Poirot and a new person working with Poirot, if I created a sidekick for Poirot for the purposes of my books about him, who would also be the narrator of those books, then that just totally dealt with that, because suddenly we've got Inspector Catchpole, who isn't a Christie character. I invented him. So he is a new voice and a new person working with Poirot, just as I am. And so that explains why my Poirot novels are a bit different from Agatha Christie's, because we've got a new person writing and telling the story.
So this story is set in 1932. So I'm curious about the research that goes into this to make sure you have all those period details correct.
Yeah. So this is a bit of a weird one. The only thing I really worried about when I agreed to write the first Poirot novel was, would I be able to do the whole historical novel thing correctly? So when Agatha was writing books set in 1932, she was in 1932. So for her, it was just writing a novel set now. And for me, that is my natural and easiest way of writing. I know everything that applies to now. Like, I don't need to look up, you know, do people have telephones in their houses now? I mean, I know because I exist now. So my worry was, would I be able to know or find out enough about the years, the periods, you know, that I was writing in order to make it work? And I didn't know the answer to that. So what I did was I reread all of Agatha's Poirot novels from the 20s and 30s. I rewatched all the David Suchet screen adaptations of those same novels. And then I just tried to I said to myself, don't worry about what you do and don't know. Just kind of almost like imaginatively jump into that period as best you can. Try and like imagine that you're in one of your favorite Poirot novels. And that was what I did. And as soon as I started writing the first book, I thought, weirdly, this does feel like it's working. Now, what I did have to do constantly was Google and ask people, did X, Y, or Z exist in 1929 or 1930? You know, because that I just don't have that knowledge. So for the first Poirot novel, I had to find out, did hotels have lifts? If hotels didn't have elevators, then some of my plot couldn't work. Luckily, there were some hotels that had elevators in 1929. But when I came to write my second Poirot novel, I really needed it to be possible for somebody to have a kidney transplant in 1930. And I happen to have a friend who's a expert kidney doctor. I thought, I'll ask him. He'll be able to tell me all about kidneys. In fact, I chose kidneys as a part of the body that might be ailing because of this friend who was a kidney doctor. So I said, listen, tell me about kidney transplants in 1930. He went, no. The first kidney transplant was 1952. I was like, oh no, this totally wrecks my whole plot. And I said to him, look, couldn't it be possible that there was like a maverick junior doctor who just attempted a kidney transplant way earlier? He was like, no. No one was doing. So I had to change something about my plot. So I do a lot of Googling, did X exist in 1932? Other than that, though, it's just immersing myself in the Agatha Christie books that were written in that period. And then some things you just know instinctively, right? Sometimes I'll find myself putting in a certain phrase and I'll go, oh, hang on, no one would have said that in 1932. So a bit of it's common sense, but there's a lot of looking things up.
And even though the story is set in 1932, do you think it's just the nature of a good mystery and human nature that doesn't change that much over time that keeps this book relevant to today's readers?
Absolutely, definitely. And one of the things about Agatha Christie's fiction, which is why it remains as brilliant now as it's ever been, is that she's always writing about those absolutely essential and fundamental human emotions, experiences. You know, she writes about people who are grief-stricken and full of bitterness because they've been betrayed by someone they love, or people who are furious because they've been mistreated in some way. And all those things are just always part of the human condition. So I think that's a big reason why her books feel so relevant today.
What's next for you? What can fans of your writing look for next?
Well, so in America, I've got two new books coming out next year, and neither of them is a Poirot. The first one, which is coming out at the end of January, is called No One Would Do What the Lamberts Have Done. And it's about a perfectly ordinary family, the Lamberts, who do the unthinkable when they decide to abandon their lives and their home and their jobs and go on the run in order to save the life of their dog. Their dog has been falsely accused of biting a neighbor's daughter. And the dog is completely innocent. We know that from the start. But the family are not willing to take the chance that the authorities might side with the other family and take their dog away as a dangerous dog. So they decide to go on the run with the dog in order to make sure they can save his life. So that's coming out in January. And then in August next year, also in America, also I'm publishing a book called The Opposite of Murder, which is one of my contemporary psychological thriller series, which starts with a woman going into a police station to confess to a plan she's made to murder somebody, because her thinking is if she confesses to this plan, then she knows she won't do it, because if it were to then happen, they'd know it was her. So she's basically like very, very tempted to commit this murder and kind of feels it's inevitable that she will, unless she does this radical step of confessing so that she then can't do it. And then it turns out that while she's in the police station talking to detectives confessing, the target of her murder plan is being murdered in exactly that way at exactly that time. And when the police find that out, they think, have we somehow cleverly been used as her alibi, because we know she can't have done it, and yet the way it was done is exactly what she's just confessed to having planned, and according to her, no one else knows about the plan. So that's The Opposite of Murder, and that's coming out in August.
Well, this current novel is The Last Death of the Year by Sophie Hanna. It's a new Hercule Poirot mystery authorized by the Agatha Christie Estate. Sophie, thank you for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me on.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen to the latest episodes on your phone or tablet, and you'll also find us on Facebook. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.